versus Overlander. Mr. Barnett darkening our door.
Good morning, Judge. We have to stop meeting like this.
Are you sure you don't want the wisdom of your partner up with you?
Could he take my place? That would be fine.
Gentlemen, good morning. I assume you both signed the sign-in sheets.
We have, Judge.
Thank you. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Barnett, would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Judge, I'll reserve 3 minutes.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Barnett. I have been was appointed as the guardian ad litem and comite for Mr. R. Overlander, who is serving a 35-year sentence currently at Greensville Correctional Center. I came into this case kind of oddly and in the middle of it. There were a number of difficulties and kind of unique twist to this case as far as the prior opinion, classification of the marital residence. A lot of difficulties in being able to meet with my client, his request that he be granted an opportunity to hire his own attorney after meeting with me, and that motion being denied. Essentially, at some point right after the separation of the parties when Mr. Overlander was incarcerated, his fines and costs were assessed against the marital home as a lien, about $3,400, if I remember correctly. In order to clear that and to deal with some other unquestionably marital debt, to refinance the house, and this was back in 2008 during the Big Bear Lehman Goldman Sachs meltdown, Mr. Overlander spoke with his wife and executed a deed transferring ownership to her so she could refinance it in order to pay off some of the marital debt.
That was post-separation deed, correct?
It was post-separation, yes, Judge. He was incarcerated at that time. He had been arrested. I can't speak to the party's state of mind as far as what their separate, were they separated? Was he just incarcerated at that time? But they were indeed at that point not living together. It's a little weird that
from the four corners of the deed itself.
Yes.
Is there anything to indicate anything other than he gave up his interest?
I don't think interest is even mentioned in that deed, Judge. It is transferred under a special warranty of title, and it just talks about transferring the title of the property. It's not one of those where it says relinquishes all rights, interest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that the deed's a little weirdly written, to be honest with you. That was discussed quite a bit in the briefs that were filed by prior counsel and Mr. Segal. I'm no real estate expert, but I don't see anything in there where he gave up his interest in it, to be quite honest with you. He transferred title of it. It would be very similar to my wife and I. If I retitle her Escalade into her name, am I giving up my interest in it? Whether it's pre or post separation. I think if I'm saying, okay, you're going to get the car, we're getting divorced, here's the title to it, that's one thing. But the essence of this transfer was to effect a refinance of the mortgage, and those proceeds were used to pay marital debt, and they were used to pay also his...
But he was no longer a recorded owner of the parcel at that point.
That's correct, Judge. Although he was still on the mortgage at that point. I believe it was a joint mortgage, so he was still obligated on the mortgage.
Counsel, is there anything, though, in terms of Appley's position or argument that everything except for how the equitable or the properties be categorized is waived in terms of the house?
No, Judge. I believe Mr. Overlander and myself objected quite strenuously to the distribution and the way it was divided. As far as even to the spousal support, Mr. Overlander made a couple of comments in there that I'm being punished for my crime.
But is there anything specific in the record that points to not just a general objection, but the required specific objection?
As to what?
As to anything other than the classification of the property.
Yes, Judge. There was some discussion later in the record about interest being assigned to the debt award, and I had objections to that, and asked that the interest not be awarded. I do believe that he had preserved the issues. The getting past the house issue, let me say with that, The proceeds were used to refinance what was marital debt and to pay off his fines and costs. And oddly enough, where we're at is, had Mr. Oberlander never filed this action, the parties would probably still be married today, or might still be married today. So I don't know what intent the court can infer from it being some 7 years later that this action was filed by Mr. Oberlander, who remained incarcerated. Throughout that, his efforts to continue to support his family in looking at the equitable distribution issues continued, and him directing his power of attorney to provide Ms. Oberlander with information on how to continue his disability portion of his benefits. They terminated when he was sentenced, and there are some exceptions that allow the family to continue to collect those disability benefits, which were $800 to $900 a month. Additionally, the Honorable, I believe, Isabel Attlee ordered him to pay child support, which he continued to pay. Throughout, over that process, it was mentioned in the record, it was about $80,000 in continued support that he provided to his family. His biggest contention here is that the 20-107-3E5, and I may misquote that, was used as a measure to punish him for his crimes.
Well, under both 5 and 11, isn't it fair to say that his crimes adversely affected the marital estate significantly, both from the cost of attorneys to defend him to the loss of income?
I would think loss of income, yes, Judge, I believe he had just started a job at North Anna at that time, had been there a very short period of time, and I'm remembering back to the transcripts of the trial that I was not involved in. He had been in school for a number of years. Ms. Oberlander had obtained one or two jobs to help support the family, which she continued until she was went down to the single job with a rather large amount of overtime. As far as affecting the corpus of the estate, I don't think that his crimes had an effect on the ICMA account, okay, her retirement account, her VRS account. It certainly didn't have an effect on the property value of the home. So as to the assets of the marriage, I would say no, there was no economic impact to those. Certainly to earning capacity, Mr. Oberlander's bring-home paycheck, I would submit that there was impact to that, yes.
Did they have an effect on the husband's contribution to the well-being of the family?
Well, Judge, I am not going to deny that his contributions were a massive negative effect. I am not going to sit here and try to put any polish on that.
Kind of piggybacking on what Judge Russell just asked you, how about on husband's contribution to the care of the marital property?
At that point, Judge, what I would say is that through his continuation of, and you looking at the record, you would see where he actually provided funds for the two daughters that to purchase vehicles. Or was it just one? I can't remember if it was Michelle or Amber, to be quite honest with you. Continuing to support or do what he can to support by paying child support, by making sure that the disability continued on, even though it was taken from him. I think he tried to contribute everything that he was capable of at that time.
And then you had to have items that were ruled upon to be separate, that is the value of the home or the equity in the home once it was transferred by your ward to his then estranged wife, but that you're arguing should have been categorized as marital. You had to have the proceeds from that went towards paying off some of his financial debt to the Commonwealth of Virginia. Is that
about
correct?
About $3,400 of it, yes, Judge. That's exactly true.
But even if he contributed to the best of his ability after his incarceration is the result of his voluntary act.
That's correct, Judge. And again, I guess the gist of it here, in speaking with what I can with Mr. Oberlander, we've done quite a bit of letter exchanging. It's very difficult to get into a state prison to see someone. His position is that, yes, his crimes were terrible. I think he took responsibility for that. But he did everything he could to support his family throughout it and feels that he was punished. If we look at what came out of this, Mr. Oberlander was apportioned about 75% of the marital debt. of about $27,000, along with $3,400 worth of reimbursement for the fines and costs. Attorney's fees around $10,000 or $9,000. He was ordered, he was given none of the retirement, or the marital share of Miss Oberlin's retirement, either ICMA or VRS. He was ordered out of what is not a significant amount of money. He gets about $1,568, I believe, total in Navy retirement. Net of that is about $1,268, I believe. Ms. Oberlander was entitled to her marital share of that. That's a DFAST decision. We're not arguing that, which would be about 32%, leaving him with somewhere around $850 a month. Out of that, he was ordered to pay $500 a month in spousal support. It's over 50% of what he would bring home. An additional $100 towards the marital debt, an additional $100 a month towards attorney's fees in this matter. It's about $700, leaving him about $150 to live on per month, $150, $160 a month. And that's my ward's position.
So, thank you, Mr. Barnett. Good morning.
Good morning. Craig Sampson for Ms. Oberlander. Judge, no question that in this, well, my usual line is it's called equitable distribution, not equal distribution. I know the court knows there's no presumption that it's going to be anywhere near 50-50, and that in appropriate circumstances it can be quite different than that. You can imagine them, but you have to think about it to find the worst facts for Mr. Oberlander than what we have here today in terms of his monetary and negative non-monetary contributions to the well-being of his family. With respect to whether or not the judge was punishing him, not that this is necessarily dispositive, but I never heard the judge actually come out and say that explicitly. It has to be inferred that he was punishing him. He never that I saw in the transcript made a statement, I'm going to punish you for what you did.
Well, when you take in non-monetary negative contributions, I mean, couldn't anyone always characterize that as punishing you for your conduct, criminal or otherwise?
You could certainly always infer that. You could state, well, how do you prove it, I guess? Is there a cutoff? It's certainly not 50%. Is it 40% or 30%? And it's an unusual case. On many levels, Ms. Oberlander's testimony was, she testified not only about the psychological devastation to her family, but the monetary devastation that this has caused to her family. And she has to keep the ship afloat. Now, I don't want to downplay or suggest that Mr. Oberlander's living situation is ideal. It certainly isn't, but he does not worry about where his next meal's coming from or whether he's going to have a roof over his head or clothes on his back, which Ms. Oberlander still has to address. So if she gets a bigger slice of the pie, that is true, but she's also dealing with a bigger slice of the fallout of his behavior. So my first argument would be, or one of my arguments would be, first of all, it was a negative non-monetary contribution to the well-being of the family. No question that it's caused non-monetary devastation on many levels. There was evidence about the PTSD and the anxiety and depression and inability to sustain relationships, etc. But there were also monetary fallout. She did have to pay off, apparently, $3,400 in fines, his criminal fines, so she could take care of the house because there was a judgment on it. She had to, she'd just been dealing with debt, working two jobs, working overtime, etc. With respect to the titling of the house, the court made, there was three arguments that were floating around. One is, was it a deed of gift? I think that the deed was probably drafted by a non-lawyer because it is a little hinky. It says deed of gift. I'm not really sure if it is a deed of gift. I am, unlike counsel, I don't know as much about real estate possibly as counsel, but I don't think that he retained any interest from that deed. It said, I'm transferring my title, and I don't think he had anything left. If he tried to sell it or put a lien on it, I don't think he gets any traction based on that deed.
No longer a recorded owner.
Yeah, I don't. What interest he may have had, I don't know in any practical sense what interest he still had after that. But the judge based his decision on two things. One is that it was a transfer after the last separation, so no presumption that it was marital. And two, that it was a marital agreement, which is an interesting argument. And I had scratched my head because I thought, well, is this a marital agreement? My initial gut reaction was, well, it's a deed. It's not a marital agreement. But the definition of marital agreement under 2151 and 2155 is just it's in writing and signed by the parties. That's pretty much all it requires. And it was in writing. It was signed by the parties, and it did transfer an interest. I can't really say it's not an agreement under the statute. So we'd argue that the judge has not abused his discretion in terms of how he divided up the property. He's not abused his discretion. And he is not. I guess the court is in as good a position to determine the deed and whether or not that was what the deed means. That's a legal question. But that on de novo review, judge, that there was no error there. I mean, he made his findings. That two, you'd have to find that both of his arguments for both of the judge's findings, one, that it was post-separation, so therefore I can find that it's not marital, or two, that it's a marital agreement. If you agree with either one of those, I win. At least I think I do. The only other issue that was brought up that was not argued was the continuance, which I think is my arguments are probably well enough laid out in the brief.
I do want to ask one question about one of your preliminary arguments. There is no dispute that he meets the definition of a person under a disability in 8.01 subsection 2.
I don't think that there is.
Okay. Well, in the security for appeal statute, it notes that when an appeal is proper to protect the estate of a decedent or a person under a disability, him, no security for appeal shall be required. Does that defeat your argument that the appeal needs to be tossed?
On the appeal bond issue?
Yes. It seems to me that's got to apply to him.
I'm not prepared to refute you definitively.
Good enough.
I'm not smart enough to be able to and I will say that is actually going up in front of the, and I'm not handling that aspect of the trial counsel. Apparently there is a motion pending that will be heard about reducing the appeal bond.
Maybe we can help them out.
I think we'll dispense with that.
I will.
Thank you for teeing it up.
You're welcome. I always like to tee it up so it can be swatted back at me. Judge, if there are questions, I would be happy to try to answer them as best I can.
No, sir. Thank you, Mr. Sampson.
Thank you.
Mr. Barnett.
Judges, I appreciate the words of Mr. Sampson, but I don't know that he could know less about real estate than I do. It's just one of the areas that I chose to set aside. As to the issue of the appeal bond, Mr. Sampson's correct. We have a bit of an issue with availability of Judge Long. He is back in Virginia from, I think, May to November. My inexperience with posting appeal bonds in this played some factor in it. My delay in ability to speak with Mr. Oberlander and his absolute inability to pay $3,500 with what he saddled with. We're going to be part of the arguments, and if the court wants to dispense with that, I'd be happy.
We'll address the bond issue.
I would be happy to take that hearing off my calendar. I believe it's set right now for June 21st. Judge, one of the things that I just kind of wanted to get to briefly when we were talking about the major part of Mr. Oberlander's position here is, in the transcripts, Judge Long did make lip service to the other factors in his decision, considering the other factors. Fault was specifically mentioned three times, come to mind. Three times. I believe that Mr. Oberlander's position is that too much or absolutely, in his mind, that was the deciding factor for everything.
Now, you note in your brief that Judge Long explicitly ruled that he was punishing Mr. Oberlander as a result of his criminal actions. Can you point us to anywhere in the record
Judge,
where he made that explicit
that
ruling?
I remember that in the brief, and I certainly would not. I
got the impression that perhaps it said explicitly, but you meant implicitly.
No, Judge. I mean, I was there. I can see the judge's demeanor. I've been in front of Judge Long for many, many years. I appreciate him. There was nothing where the court said, I am going to put the hammer down on you because of what you did. Certainly, and I would say this, in any other given set of circumstances, if Mr. Oberlander had gone to jail for grand larceny or drug addiction or something of that nature, or if he had just picked up and moved out, given the relative earning abilities, assets that are available to the parties, I can't see where this would be the outcome. If he were a retired Navy person.
Definitionally, don't the underlying events here have a greater negative impact on the family than if he had just stolen something?
On the children and the wife, yes, Judge. Without a doubt. Without a doubt they do. On the, again, getting back to it, if he had packed up and moved out with his Navy pension, I'm not going to sit here and speculate, but I just don't see where he would be left with $168 a month to live off of in any other trial on a matter like this. It's an outcome where a man's left with less than 10% of what he earns. I don't know that I've ever seen that before. That's Mr. Oberlander's kind of reasoning to me is everything was taken, and it was because of what I did. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Barnett. We will come down and greet counsel.